National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
New accusations of sexual misconduct have been made against Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh, and it did not take long for their credibility to be called into question. The question now is, has the political atmosphere grown even darker in Washington, D.C.? This week on Register Radio, we talked to Register Senior Editor Joan Desmond for the latest. Plus, the German bishops are pushing ahead with a plan for a special synodal assembly that could transform the church in Germany and even beyond. We get all the details from Edward Penton, Register Rome correspondent. Hello, I'm Matthew Bunsen, the senior editor for the Register and co-host of Register Radio. My co-host, editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register, Jeanette DiMello, is off this week. Well, Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh has been accused again of sexual misconduct, certainly dating back many decades, in a controversial and now seriously questioned New York Times essay and book describing alleged behavior that occurred during his college years at Yale. Serious questions have been raised about the credibility of the accusation, but Democratic candidates for president have wasted no time in calling for his impeachment. What does all of this mean for the state of political affairs, and will this impact the life of the court and some of the decisions that are upcoming by the court? Joan Farley Desmond joins us to discuss the situation and to tell us about several other recent stories that she's written in the Register, including the Peanut Butter Falcon. Hello, Joan, and welcome back to Register Radio.
Hey, Matthew. Always good to be here.
Well, here we are once again talking about Brett Kavanaugh, but interestingly enough, it's not really about the decisions he's making or the votes he's giving in terms of his opinions on the high court. It's sort of an obsession now with a lot of people in the media, not just even his recent past, but I mean going back decades to his time in high school and now in Yale. What's happening here?
Well, honestly, Matthew, I don't know if a lot of us are prepared to take this up again. So many people are just exhausted. But after a year, we're still sort of experiencing PTSD dealing with this. But basically, the situation is over the weekend, I believe it was September 5th or 15th or 16th, the New York Times published an essay by two Times reporters who had spent the last almost full year reporting on what they said was a new book, providing new information and investigating in more detail Kavanaugh's history as a high school student and college student, which many people, you know, over the past decades thinking about Supreme Court justices wouldn't have given much attention to this. But because of Christine Blasey Ford's allegations, which dated back to their high school years, this now has become ripe for further discussion and investigation. As a result, the two reporters produced their essay, which kicked off their new book, which is kind of a familiar thing now with all this kind of reporting. And their main claim to fame was what they described as a, quote, previously unreported or undisclosed story or allegation involving his Yale college years. And this involved the justice as a college student, reportedly exposing himself to a female student. So supposedly this had never been revealed before, but it since turned out the Washington Post had said that they had heard this allegation the previous year. Apparently the FBI had looked into it. The Post opted not to pursue it because they couldn't verify the details. And so it really raised questions kind of like, well, why are they leading with this? But one of the key omissions in their essay, which did appear in their book, was that this woman, the so-called victim, has told friends she doesn't remember the incident and refused to talk to the reporters. So they got the information secondhand through somebody else who said he saw it. He was initially described as nonpartisan, but has since been identified as a former Clinton legal aide. So it's just raised a lot of questions. You know, we don't know all the background, but all we can say is it's not looking good. The Times has had to issue clarification. They also issued another story trying to further explain themselves. And I think it's just raising more questions about how politicized our news is getting, where people feel like there's alternative realities on display here.
Well, I'm reminded, sort of Kavanaugh, certainly we have seen there is this kind of obsession with him. and doing everything they can either to bring about his impeachment or certainly to destroy his reputation to the point where he either is forced to step down or simply, much like Clarence Thomas, as they've tried to do the same thing, to ruin him for life.
Well, what's interesting too, Matthew, sorry to intervene, but just to say, I think what's interesting is what is reported and what is not reported, right? So before this New York Times reporter's book was released, Carrie Severino and Molly Hemingway, Molly's a Fox News contributor on their show, and Carrie Severino is the legal director for the Judicial Crisis Network, which she's been involved in a lot of the she herself is a Clarence Thomas. she worked for him. So Carrie Severino clerked for Thomas and now is the legal director for the Judicial Crisis Network and has worked on a number of these super contentious Supreme Court confirmation battles. And so they had already interviewed another important subject, which was Leland Kaiser. Leland is the friend of Blasey Ford, who supposedly had been at this this evening when Ford was allegedly assaulted by Kavanaugh. Now, Kaiser had never said that she remembered it, but she said that she, quote, believed Ford in the sense that she was her friend and supported her just in a general sense. Well, since then, she told both the Times reporters and Carrie Severino and Molly Hemingway that actually she now just didn't believe it at all, and just the whole thing didn't make sense. She said, as a freshman, I wouldn't have stayed at this party, but these older boys from Georgetown Prep, she still said she never didn't know Kavanaugh and never met him. That's an additional issue. It did come up finally when people started to look more closely at the controversial new book. They then said, well, you know, what about this issue? That didn't appear in the Times essay either. And yet it's a pretty important point. So since then, that has come out more, and the Washington Post kind of reported that separately as an important development. I mean, what are we hearing and what are we not hearing? It kind of depends on who you read and who you don't read.
Right. So this is one of those classic cases of all the news that's fit to print, but they really do get to decide what they're going to print.
So let's turn on to the third book, which I think is really interesting too, Matthew, because here Ryan Lovelace, who writes for the National Law Journal, you know, really reputable group, he wrote a book called Search and Destroy, also looking at how Kavanaugh's confirmation was handled. And he was able to get a tape of Deborah Katz, who is Ford's previous, who was Ford's lawyer at the confirmation hearings. And you may recall a lot of people questioned the fact that ostensibly this was a Me Too moment, and yet Katz had really deep Democrat Party connections. So people said, is this about Me Too? Is it really about abortion politics? Like, what's really going on here? Well, at this Baltimore meeting, University of Baltimore meeting recently, by a group called the Feminist Legal Theory Conference, she gave a talk called Applied Feminism and Me Too. And she said basically that Ford's decision to step forward means that Kavanaugh, quote, will always have an asterisk next to his name. When he takes a scalpel to Roe v. Wade, we will know who he is. We will know, you know, we will know him and his character, essentially.
Right.
So this is bringing us back to the same issue that people from the beginning of this whole confirmation battle said, yes, if they're legitimate allegations, let's hear them. But if these are really flimsy, what's really going on here?
Well, I want to sort of have a bit of a change of pace here and talk about something a little happier, which is a piece you wrote that has been very popular with our readers, and that is about an actor with Down syndrome who starred in The Peanut Butter Falcon, a recent film that garnered a 95% rating from Rotten Tomatoes. So just very briefly, tell us about that story.
I love this movie. I mean, it's a really simple movie. I hadn't even seen it. A friend of mine had asked me if I wanted to go, and I'm so glad she did. And it's a super simple story. It has a kind of Mark Twain element to it. So what happens is there's a man. He's in a nursing home. He has Down syndrome. He doesn't belong in a nursing home. He belongs in a group home. He belongs in his family's home, but his family is gone, and so as a ward of the state, this is the only place they can find to put him. So with the help and guidance of one of the nursing home residents, he manages to escape. So why is he escaping and where does he want to go? Well, over the time in the nursing home, he's been watching these old movies about a pro wrestler. And this wrestler, I can't remember the wrestler's name. It's one of these really great names, though. And this wrestler ostensibly trains people to be pro wrestlers. Well, Zach, this young man who has Down syndrome, decides he wants to go and find this pro wrestler and get trained up.
Yeah.
So he escapes from the nursing home and sneaks onto a truck, which is driven by a young man, Tyler. Tyler is kind of a small-time crook and crab fisherman who is on the run from a really bad guy. And so basically they have a bunch of adventures kind of on and off the water. There's a makeshift raft, a young woman from the nursing home who's dispatched to find Zach and bring him back but starts to have second thoughts, meets up with the duo. And what's really beautiful about it, Matthew, is that it's just a celebration, really, of their common humanity.
Exactly.
And at the start of the film, he escapes in underwear, and so you think, oh, a young, you know, Down syndrome man wearing underwear is going to be a real figure of fun, but he's not, because his vulnerability and warmth really comes through and disarms Tyler, the man who decides to help him, and also the audience. I mean, we really just love this character and are just completely on board with who he is.
And we need more stories like this. Before you go, I also want to plug a piece that you have coming up on a profile of Archbishop Charles Chaput. I would encourage everyone to go to ncregister.com to take a look at that. Well, Joan, as always, I appreciate your writing, and I look forward to reading more of you in the coming weeks.
Thanks, Matthew. Appreciate it. Enjoy the day.
Well, when we come back, I talk with Rome correspondent Edward Penton and his story of news from the Vatican. And there's a lot to talk about, especially with the Germans and Cardinal Pell. This is Register Radio. More when we return.
There's nothing like EWTN's National Catholic Register. Revealing, engaging, inspiring. The most comprehensive news of the day from a Catholic perspective, with the moral authority that comes from being faithful to the teachings of the Catholic Church. And in the words of our founder, Monsignor Matthew Smith, a paper that will always be loyal to the Church and has no selfish axe to grind. Because the truth when the Register was founded in 1927 is still the truth today. The award-winning National Catholic Register helps readers engage the culture with confidence in the saving and sanctifying gospel of Jesus Christ. Get 6 free issues today by ordering online at ncregister.com/radio or call 800-421-3230 and mention code RADIO. That's 800-421-3230 and mention code RADIO. The National Catholic Register. Read faithfully.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back to Register Radio. I'm Matthew Bunsen, filling in this week for Jeanette DeMello, our editor-in-chief and co-host of Register Radio, who's off this week. Well, the German bishops have declared their intention to continue down a radical binding synodal path that includes the creation of an unprecedented synodal assembly in close partnership with the progressive lay group that has demanded the ordination of women, an end to clerical celibacy, the blessing of same-sex unions by the Church, and rethinking of all Catholic teaching on sexuality. What lies ahead for German Catholics, and is there a schism in Germany on the horizon? To discuss this story, and as we always do, other news from the Vatican, we turn to Edward Penton, Register Rome correspondent, who I am very happy to have with me here in studio in Washington, D.C. Welcome back to the United States, Edward.
Thanks. Good to be with you, Matthew, here in D.C. for a change.
For a change, yes, exactly. Well, I know the weather's been pretty brutal in Rome the last couple of months.
It gets pretty hot, yes.
Well, same here, but I think you've been in for a perfect time of weather here.
Yes.
At least I hope you think so.
Yes, beautiful. No, lovely.
Well, things are, while we're on the weather analogy, things are turning somewhat frosty in Germany at the moment. Mm. We have been hearing for a while that the Germans were plotting something into the German bishops, headed by Cardinal Reinhard Marx, the Archbishop of Munich and Freising, who's also the president of the German Episcopal Conference, that they wanted to have some sort of a synodal process. What do they mean by that?
Yes, well, they want to have a sort of synodality in their own bishops' conference, and this means basically that they want to move ahead with their own views, as you said earlier, on sexual morality and other issues. And they want to do it independent, really, of Rome as much as possible. And they're trying to, I think, sort of exploit, if you like, the Pope's push for synodality, and they're trying to use it in their own, using their own sort of paradigm for it. And I think if we remember, I mean, I don't know if you do remember, back in 2015, Cardinal Marx said famously, "We're not a subsidiarity of Rome," I think. I think something like that. But anyway, that we're not going to...
Like
not
just a branch office of
Rome.
Yes,
exactly.
Yes.
So it goes back even further than that. And I think they've wanted to sort of branch out on their own and do their own thing. And I think things are getting... They seem to be having a sense of urgency about it, and this is quite an interesting aspect too.
Now, we know that the Vatican has rebuked some of the working documents that have been proposed. There's been a lot of back and forth. We've had a letter from Cardinal Marc Bouyet, the prefect for the Congregation for Bishops, essentially rejecting their proposals. Mm. We've had another letter from I think it's the Pontifical Council for Legislative Texts. Is that right?
Yes.
Also rejecting them. And the term that I've seen used is that it is not ecclesiologically valid.
Yes.
What's been the reaction then of the Vatican? What do they mean by that?
Well, I mean, they obviously don't agree with this position that they're holding, and they want to stop it. But I think what's also interesting is, and it was kind of overlooked because it was in the summer, but I think the Pope wrote a letter to the German bishops, which also told them, advised them not to go down this path. And it turns out, I understand, that the publication Herder in Germany said that the letter was actually helped, the Pope was helped to write the letter by Cardinal Walter Kasper. So even if, you know, those, if they're also not wanting it and they're still pushing ahead, that shows that there really is a strong determination to go ahead with this, regardless of whatever the Pope says. And this doesn't augur well for the future, I think.
And for those who may not remember, Cardinal Walter Kasper is somewhat of a, now among a lot of Catholics, I hate to say the word notorious figure, but a very famous figure coming out of the synods of the bishops in 2014-2015 that ended with Amoris Laetitia on the question of communion for the civilly divorced and remarried.
Yes, that's right. And some might argue, you know, that the seeds were sown because of this, and that there wasn't much of a direction, you know, a clear pushback from anyone who was reading these documents in a not in light of traditional continuity, and in a sense, a sort of reaping the fruits of that. And so, I think that's an interesting point. But I do think that there is this genuine push that they're wanting to take, and I think it's because they feel that there's perhaps, I don't know, they may be thinking that the Pope only has obviously a limited time left, and that they're worried that perhaps somebody might come in after him who's going to be more conservative and then stop them pursuing these views, pursuing this line. And so they're keen to push this while they can, I think.
And there's a lot of talk in Germany about an impending demographic crisis, not just for the Catholic community, but also for Protestants all across the country. Mm. We're looking at declining numbers. I think there was a recent study that found that by 2016, is that right, the Christian faith will be only half of what it is today. So are the German bishops trying to respond in some way to that impending catastrophe? But is this actually the right prescription? Because this is the one that the Protestants have been using for some time, and we're certainly watching their numbers continuing to decline in even more rapid.
Yes, exactly. Well, I think something like 200,000 Catholics left last year, and it's a constant hemorrhaging of faithful in Germany. And And what you've got essentially are well-funded churches through the church tax, but they're just increasingly empty. And so you've got these beautiful churches, very well maintained, but nobody in them. And it's a sort of hollowed out church in Germany now. And it, as you say, it's because, well, a lot of people think it's because of the fact that they've gone down this path and they're just making themselves irrelevant to the German society. And this is why you've got this complete emptying out. Yeah.
The German bishops also rejected, didn't they, a counter-proposal from, I think it was Cardinal Rainer Wilke of Cologne, who actually was encouraging them to embrace the synodal path that Pope Francis tried to lay out for them back in June.
That's right. It was put together by Bishop Rudolf Vorderholzer of Regensburg and Cardinal Wilke of Cologne, and they... Yes, and that was rejected, quite roundly rejected by the Permanent Council of the German Bishops, I think 21 votes to 2 or something like that. So yes, the German bishops as a whole seem to be wanting to push this, and there's just a minority who are standing up against this direction.
And one of the other questions that's emerged out of this is this synodal assembly that seems to be the Central Committee of German Catholics. Mm. What do you know about them?
The lay Catholics, well, I think they're quite radical. I mean, from what I've heard, that they have a quite significant influence in Germany, and so I think yes, there's a lot of influence there from them. But also, it's also worth remembering, I think part of this story is back in last year. You may remember the big controversy over intercommunion and the fact that there were. The bishops' conference were pushing this guideline, these guidelines for allowing Holy Communion for Protestant spouses, and that was very controversial. And it was taken to Rome, and we all thought, or a lot of people thought, that the Vatican would uphold the Church's teaching on this. But in the end, the Pope went along with what the German bishops were wanting. So I think that perhaps gave them. Extra sort of sense of confidence that they could pursue this as well, and that in fact the Pope might come around to that view as well.
So, and Cardinal Marx at the time said, I don't remember the exact German phraseology, but he said basically, "I am determined to do this."
Yes, that's right, and they are very determined. The German Church, the German bishops, and if they want to do something, they'll try by hook or by crook to get it. And I think that's what we're seeing. Yeah.
So what are the odds of a potential schism emerging out of all of this once the synodal process completes its undertaking?
Mm. Well, I mean, it really depends. I mean, it really is a standoff now, and I think we just got to see how the Vatican responds to whatever final document they put out on this and the direction that they take. And if they can maintain the position that they've taken before, then it will seem as though Rome has succumbed to their wishes and submitted to them and allowed it to go forward. But that would set a pretty serious precedent going forward, because it would show that bishops' conferences, presumably, can do whatever they want, and the Vatican will just go along with it.
And there is a plan, isn't there, for them to translate this document into multiple languages and sort of send it around the world to other Episcopal conferences and other Catholic groups?
Yes, well, I think they probably would see this as something that could be copied by other bishops' conferences, yes. I mean, this is a worldview of the Church that they have, and I think they would like it accepted elsewhere. Yeah.
And all of this is happening just within a few weeks of the start of the Synod on the Amazon, which is grappling with some of the very same pastoral questions that the German bishops are confronting.
Yes, and I think this is going to be interesting, because there's a lot of German influence on this synod, and there's going to be a lot of pushes, I think, to get this sort of agenda through the Amazon Synod. I mean, some even go so far as to suggest that the synod is really a vehicle for the German Church to do this. I don't know if it's quite like that, but I do think that there will be efforts made to use this to their advantage. Yeah.
So, changing gears, let's go back to Australia and the ongoing ordeal of Cardinal George Pell.
Yes. Well, that as we saw last week, He has submitted application to appeal to the High Court in Australia. This is his last avenue of appeal. People are generally skeptical because often appeals don't succeed. And I understand if they go to the High Court, it's even less likely to succeed. But his lawyers are confident because of the split decision on the appeal in August, where two judges voted to uphold the conviction and one dissented from it. And now they say that shows that it is it's not beyond reasonable doubt, and that there is real a problem here, that and that there really is a case to be made that he's innocent. So we'll see. But it's going to take a while, I think, for this process to work out.
So in your view, having covered this story now, and you also know Cardinal Pell, what are your thoughts of the likelihood of this appeal being actually granted?
I don't really know. I mean, I think one has to have a better knowledge of the Australian system to really give a clearer opinion on this. But I have read that the stakes are extremely high now for everyone involved, because his defense lawyers are now pushing the case that he's innocent, and their appeal has been very strongly worded against the two judges who voted against who voted for the conviction, and so everyone is heavily invested in this, and I think the conclusion will be very significant, not just for Cardinal Pell but for everyone involved. So there's a lot riding on this, and it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Well, yeah. I'm sure we'll be hearing from you when the time comes.
Yes.
And we all look forward to everything that you contribute to the National Catholic Register, as well as your hits on EWTN News Nightly.
You're welcome. Good to be with you, Matthew.
Edward Penton, Rome correspondent for the National Catholic Register. Well, that wraps up our show for this week. Remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Thanks so much for joining me on Register Radio here on EWTN. For Jeanette DeMello and our producer, Jeff Burson, I'm Matthew Bunsen. Until next week, please take care and God bless.
For more information about the National Catholic Register and about Register Radio, go to ncregister.com. Podcasts of Register Radio are posted on ncregister.com and on ewtn.com. Join us next week at this time for Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.